for people in pain. I like to is this too loud? I like to speak in the morning about suffering of some kind or another, and it's a good topic because it's kind of endless. So the particular form of suffering that I've chosen to talk about this morning is the suffering that arises out of our past karma. The stuff that right now you think you can't do anything about because it happened in the past. And one of Bodhidharma's four essential practices that encompass all others in the little work or the little writing of his that we have, he sets out four essential practices that encompass all the others. And one of them, this is how much he thought of this topic, is enduring the results of past actions. And I read now his work from Zen Chinese Heritage by Andy Ferguson, his paragraph on enduring the results of past actions. How does one endure the results of past actions? Those who may be said to practice the way, upon encountering difficult times, think to themselves, for endless culpas without beginning, I've forsaken what is essential and pursued the frivolous. I've been tossed by currents and waves, committing sins and transgressions without end. Now, although I commit no transgressions, it is my accumulated misdeeds, my store of evil karma, which continues to bear fruit. None among the heavens of humankind can see from whence it arises. Without rancor or recriminating thoughts, I accept this. So that's a pretty tall order. So I'd like to speak a little bit this morning about what that means without, well, to me, without rancor or recriminating thoughts, I accept this. So first of all, why is this so important to our practice that Bodhidharma, a mythical person, or if he was a person, he now has the status of myth, if he thought it was one of the four most important practices, I tend to go in that direction. So when I think of why this is so important to our practice, first of all, in seeing students, I noticed that a lot of people waste their time in remorse and guilt over terrible things that they've done, or in anger and resentment over what's been done to them by parents or institutions. And blaming is beside the point. I mean, it might feel better when people blame other people for their problems. It feels better to do that because then you feel empowered. You feel like, well, I'm mad at so-and-so, because if you look at the actual thing that's happened to you, you're the person it was done to, and you feel powerless. So anger helps in that it makes us feel better, but it can distract us from sitting in our own lives now. To keep saying, my parents did this, even though some parents have done terrible things, or that institution did this, my work, the government, Zen Center, whoever, did this to me, is actually a distraction from being able to sit in your own life right now. So another problem that students often present me with is sometimes practitioners get very discouraged when they don't see the results of practicing the precepts in terms of a reward for their virtue, their effort to be aware and careful. When people start practicing the precepts, it's a wonderful thing to see, actually. People begin to be mindful. about what they're doing and what might be the results of what they do for other people. And people, upon embarking on a study of the precepts, often discontinue what they see to be an unwholesome lifestyle. And the consequences of that old life, however, continue to play out. This is very discouraging for people. For instance, I have a student who's an ex-gang member. Probably none of you know that about this person. But he feels like giving up sometimes. His path is full of temptations from his past, which must be handled one temptation at a time. His life is still intruded upon by old dope dealers, old connections, old sex partners, tax agent, he never paid his taxes, old bill collectors, he never paid bills, and so on. And so these are the loose ends for him, starting a new life, that range from really annoying, like old bills which now have tons of interest on them. So if the old bill was $50, it's now $375, or that kind of thing, because they accumulate interest. But that's really annoying compared to some of the things he has to be concerned with. For instance, when he started a new life, he needed some money, so he tried to collect unemployment benefits. But he was turned down because his old boss, when he was on crack, he had this job, his old boss was angry enough at him to come to his unemployment hearing. Now, how bad do you have to be? How terrible do you have to be to people to make them actually take time out of their lives to prevent you from getting government money? Well, however bad that is, he did it. So he often feels like giving up on his new life, because he's living like a citizen now, paying off all these bills, getting to work on time. He's clean, but he's being treated like a bum. Sometimes he squirms with remorse for what he's done, or seethes with anger at the fact that he's now a good boy, but this stuff keeps happening to him. And he needs a lot of support from friends, from me, from other supporters to be upright and stay on his path. So when we look at things this way, it's not accurate. When we look at things from a reward and punishment point of view, it's not accurate. It doesn't describe reality. Practice and results are not related in the way that we think they are. We think that one comes before the other and actually has some influence on the other. And sometimes we confuse things working well for us with our practice must be good. It must be going successfully. Well, that's a very simplistic way to think about things. I'm good and virtuous, therefore I deserve to be rewarded. If you think this way, you'll never really understand causality. That's for one. For one, you won't understand causality. And maybe that's not so important for you. But the real tragedy is that your world will be stunted by this narrow idea of cause and effect, that they follow each other in rigid and narrow succession. Your energy will be sapped by preoccupation with justifying your actions when the results of your actions are ambiguous, or you're trying to behave in a certain way so that certain things will happen to you. But actually, practicing results are like practicing realization. They're one and the same. Form is exactly emptiness. Emptiness is exactly form. It's the same with cause and effect. Cause is exactly effect. Effect is exactly caused. They don't follow each other in real life, just in our ideas. And when we think in terms of cause and effect, which is a schema that we're imposing on the flow of reality, when we think in terms of this and think of that as being real, we're actually mixing up the elements of things in a very narrow way, like picking out two people in this room that have brown hair and assuming that they're sisters or brothers. That's information. In fact, maybe they are related in that 6 degrees of separation way. But as far as useful information that you can use to learn something, they're completely unrelated. It's just too complex. The only real thing is you right now doing what you're doing, being who you are, not the ideas that you have about it. So cause and effect can't be understood and dissected by the gaining and losing mind that we use to analyze our practice. If the only resource you think that you have is your thinking conceptual brain, you're operating in a dark closet. You have to widen your playing field a little bit to admit into your understanding other ways of knowing. For instance, as an example of this cause and effect, virtue and reward kind of thing, I have a student who's a terrible driver. He's a very kind man, but he really is a terrible driver. He gets in little fender benders all the time. And I've driven with him, and I've tried to locate exactly what the problem is. Is it that he focuses on maybe 3 feet in front of him? And so when, you know, a car comes 10 feet away, oh, no, no, no. It might be that, but I'm not quite sure. Anyway, well, after he set his first 7 day session here, he got really high and wide and fast, and he was so happy. And he went out to get in his car to go home, and he thought, this is it, this is the test. He got in the car and pulled out right in front of a car that was coming and had a fender bender. And he said, oh my God, I'm the same person. So he confused practice with the changes that he wanted to see in his life. And this is common. But actually, I'm sorry to tell you this, actually practice is its own reward, like virtue. Not that practice and virtue are the same. And consciousness is its own reward. People always think when they practice mindfulness that their life will get better. Well, actually, it does. But not for the reason they think. Not because they're now virtuous. But because mindfulness helps us be aware of our lives. It's misleading to frame subsequent events from our practice, from a particular practice, as the results of that practice. Now, there is a very famous koan called Pai Chang and the Fox, and this is the second case in the Mumon Kan. It's about karma, causation, and it speaks directly to the conditions of our human life, whether we individually are deluded or enlightened. Good or bad, or wise, deluded. So basically the case is this. A priest was supposedly changed into a fox because he answered a student's question with a definitive dualistic answer. And the question was, is an enlightened person free of cause and effect? Is an enlightened person free of cause and effect? And he answered, yes. So So it's not that that answer is wrong particularly, because actually if you read the Four Noble Truths, that's exactly what they lead us to expect. But it does reflect, that answer in saying just yes, does reflect the limitations that I've been pointing out with dividing events that happen to us into cause and effect. In this case, based on states of mind, enlightenment, or delusion. Plus, in the real world, in the real world that you and I inhabit, with teachers and students in it, the relative world, the firm world that we understand, that answer cuts off the asker's opportunity, the student's opportunity to acknowledge his own ancient twisted karma. It cuts off the arduous practice path of radical self-acceptance, of sitting in one's own actual life, because it points toward chasing enlightenment. So it's like a tax loophole. It's like life is suffering, but you don't have to suffer if you achieve a particular state of mind. So it points the student toward chasing enlightenment. And like all the sutras do, actually, if you read them in terms of reward and punishment, they all do if you read them that way, reward and punishment. So the priest had to be a fox for 500 lifetimes. That's what happened. And the fox is really bad in Asian culture. It's not cute like in our culture. Like maybe a rat for us. Maybe that would be analogous, you know, a wily, intelligent, or a blue jay at Tassajara, something like that. Wily, intelligent, completely immoral. So he was changed into a fox for that answer. Maybe. So Ruman is the one who compiled the Numan Khan, all these koans. And he comments on them. And this is a sentence from his comment. He says, if you have the single eye of realization, in other words, if you can see the oneness of things, you will appreciate how old Pai Ching, that's the name of the monk, or the priest, you can appreciate how old Pai Ching lived 500 lives as a fox, as lives of grace. As lives of grace. This is the most important point. He lived those 500 years as lives of grace. So how would you live a rat's life as a life of grace? Maybe you're already doing that. How would you live that life as a life of grace? As a blessed, happy life. So this, to be able to do that is to be able, no matter what the circumstances of your life, and everyone in this room probably has circumstances pretty good compared to 90% of the world's population. So no matter what the circumstances of your life, to be able to be present with your whole mind and body, that's living a life of grace. Meditation practice may be said to create a person whose happiness is not dependent on circumstances. The immediacy of each moment, the immediacy of each activity allows us to understand what it means to take responsibility for our lives. To take immediate responsibility for our lives. So an overwhelmingly more useful focus of your attention rather than on the results of your practice. It's more useful to focus on your own mind at any particular time. This is mind settling on mind. You find your karma in your own mind right now. So another example. I have a student, a woman whose daughter had a child, in other words, her granddaughter. And she had always has always had a rocky relationship with her daughter, but immediately after the grandchild was born, which is what every mother, that's the real pinnacle of existence, is when the grandchild is born. Just trust me on this. So, what did this daughter do? She refused to let my student see her grandchild. So, my student tried strategy after strategy. She tried getting furious and threatening to never see her again, her daughter. She tried being sweet and passive. Whatever was said to her over the phone, whatever, she, yes, yes, no matter how she felt. She tried talking to the daughter's husband, her son-in-law, as an ally. Nothing worked. So she talked to me about this for months. I mean, she was so distraught. I mean, her pain and my identification with her pain was so terrible. I said, look, you have a son. Just cut your losses. But she said, I can't. But anyway, it happened during this time that she became a camp counselor at a camp for gifted children. And she went to the camp as a counselor, and the kids loved her. She was the one who was sought after, who was confided in, who everybody wanted to sit by at dinner. She was loved at this camp. And when she said goodbye after a couple of weeks, the children all just clamored. They brought all their parents over to meet her. So she came back and she said, so why isn't my daughter, why doesn't my daughter feel this way? Or at least kindly toward me. Well, I said, do you think you feel differently about your daughter than you do about the children in the camp, who are just other people's children? So she thought about this for a while, and then she came into this painful, painful understanding of her attachment, her expectations of her child, and her what she'd held up for her daughter all those years as a mother. She said, it's my fault. It's my fault. She accepted her part completely. And because we're not talking about the results today, I'm not going to tell you what happened. Because that actually, I mean, it makes a nice story, but it's not relevant. She accepted her part. And recently, I've been talking to a student right in the middle of the throes of her realizing and understanding how much her crazy mother has influenced her own relationships. She's right in the throes of this, the horror of seeing this. So she sits right now in the throes of her own karma. She sits very uncomfortably in her own karma, how she's internalized her mother and what that means for her own relationships, to treat people like her mother treated her. She realizes. She told me, she said, our whole family, we have to be on guard all the time because she may go off at any minute. We've had to do this ever since I was a toddler. And then she realized this is what some students say about her. And she just overwhelmed. So the first question that she presented when we talked was, how should she deal with her mother? That was the first thing. That was before she even got more into what the implications are for her. Should she, disown her mother? This is from the exact opposite of the other student, who was the mother. This is the daughter realizing how her mother has influenced her. So so obviously, though, her mother's extraneous to this. If what her mother has done is done, we're talking about her karma, the way she relates to people, the way she treats people. So blaming is beside the point. It's putting off, as I said earlier, the acknowledgement of our ancient twisted karma. Other people's being responsible for their own actions is a separate issue. So forgiving other people is something you do for yourself. For yourself. They may be oblivious. They may not even realize they have to be forgiven. It's something you do for yourself. And you begin the forgiveness process by acknowledging your own ancient twisted karma. When you forgive yourself and your parents for being themselves and yourself, you're the one with your karma, with your humanness. You're humans living 500 lives as a fox has lives of grace. You know you're a fox, and so you're a fox completely. You're a fox completely. So we can't simplify the complexities of causality to some reward and punishment scheme. We have to play on a wider field. It's much more straightforward to understand that when certain conditions arise, we hurt and we cry or we get angry or we lash out at people. When certain conditions arise, that's what we do. That's all. And when certain conditions arise, we're very happy. That's all. When certain conditions arise. For example, sometimes wonderful things just happen. They're not necessarily rewards for how virtuous you are. Sometimes they happen when people aren't virtuous at all. For instance, if it's the 60s, and you're young and friendly. They happen then. This happened to my husband and his girlfriend of the time. They went up to Mount Tam just before sunset to smoke some hash. They got up there, they seated themselves by some bushes and just lit up and watched the sunset. It was absolutely wonderful. But then human minds, being what they are, she said, gee, I wish we had some champagne. And in the next couple of minutes, two hands poked through the bushes with glasses of champagne. There happened to be a couple on the other side of the bush, and they overheard this conversation. So the two couples got together and enjoyed their hash and champagne while the sun was So this was not the result of anything. I mean it. The conditions arose. The conditions arose. We don't know why the other couple went up there and sat beside that bush. So women first on the Pai Chang in the Fox Koan is not falling, not ignoring, odd and even around one die. Not ignoring, not falling, hundreds and thousands of regrets. Hundreds and thousands of regrets. Doesn't that fit? So, not falling into the trap of enlightenment, but not ignoring causation. Not only odd and even around one die, but form and emptiness around one die, cause and effect around one die, enlightenment and delusion are all on one die, good and bad are all on one die. They have one source. Not ignoring enlightenment, not falling into causation. hundreds and thousands of regrets. So this is the simultaneous acknowledgement of your ancient twisted karma and releasing it at the same time, the hundreds and thousands of regrets. Feeling the pain and joy of simultaneously acknowledging your karma and releasing it. Why is it built this way? I don't know. Why it makes us so happy to acknowledge our ancient twisted karma, I can't tell you. This happens in my pain workshops too. People are very confused. My dichotomy, the dichotomy that's on the guide for me, is suffering and delight. And when people talk about their suffering in the workshop, they are very confused sometimes by the fact that delight comes up. They actually like to talk about their suffering. So this is why we love the full moon ceremony so much. We sit in our ancient twisted karma and avow it. So you can change your karmic life to dharmic life. It's a good motto, don't you think? You can change your karmic life to dharmic life by paying attention, by settling on your mind. It's not necessary to change your behavior. It's not necessary. People often do. But if you think that it's necessary, it puts undue pressure on your ability to see, to pay attention to your actions. So it's not necessary to change behavior. Just change the focus of your attention to your mind itself. Not on picking out a couple of events that follow each other and connecting them. This is a misleading focus of our attention. For instance, the terrible driver has learned to focus on what kicks him out of the present moment. He's learned to focus on that so that when it comes up, he understands that he's entering blindness. I'm entering blindness now. And the gang member, the ex-gang member, he's learned to focus on what does it feel like to actually bear his suffering rather than obliterate his consciousness with drugs and violence. This requires a tremendous amount of stability. And his Zazen practice helps tremendously. So he's gradually stabilizing, standing solid, practicing the precepts, enduring. And the drama of his old life gives way to a sense of purpose. Relief at being directed toward not harming. Didn't everybody's mother, just about everybody's mother, teach you about not harming? Even if it was hypocritical from your own mother, you didn't see it carried out in terms of action. Still, this is something we learn very early. Not harming. We learn that this is desirable. So, his current life is beginning to be satisfying in itself. And this is what he must focus on. How does he feel right now about his life? About the life he's living now? So I have another student who I'd like to use as an example in talking about karmic life and dharmic life. She's practiced for many years. And she has a new boyfriend. She's practiced for about 10 years or so. And in this past year, her new boyfriend took her to a party of his friends. She didn't know any of them. And he somehow forgot, or it slipped his mind, to introduce her to people, to take her around and introduce her to people. He later said, well, whenever I thought of it, there you were conversing with somebody, and it seemed like you were, you know, getting along just fine. So I thought it might be too formal to take you around. But that was later, when she told him how hurt she was, that he hadn't taken that formal step. So what came up for her is old feelings of worthlessness. He doesn't even think I'm worthy to introduce to his friends. He doesn't think, he might feel embarrassed to introduce me. All this just immediately came up. And when it came up, when she thought these thoughts, she did think, well, this is what my conditioning is. I've always felt this way. She came from a very large family. She was a middle child in that family, and so she was not the cute new baby or the older one taking care. She was just kind of didn't have a clear role in a large family. So she was able then to understand that this was the source of her feelings. Old stuff that may or may not have anything to do with what she was feeling now. So she did feel these feelings. And she could see the emptiness of the feelings. And by that I mean she could see that they weren't ultimate reality. That maybe they were just her point of view. That's what I mean by emptiness in this case. She could just see, oh, this is my viewpoint, somebody else might see it a different way. So she decided that she would check with him later and bring this up to him. But what the decision she did make that was very important is to feel the feelings. Not many people jump to their higher consciousness right there to cut off discomfort, and they think this is practice. It's not feeling it and recognize the feeling of your feelings and recognizing this. You have to have these feelings in order to recognize the conditioning, to recognize the emptiness. So she was willing to have the feelings. And again, this is what the stability of meditation practice offers you, a chance to sit stably and let whatever arises arise. This is very important. It limits your learning if you cut off feelings too early. She could have just thought, oh, I'm feeling bad, but if I feel bad, it might interfere with my having a good time at the party, and it's probably silly anyway. I know he loves me. That's too early. That's too early to see the feelings as empty. They haven't come up yet. They're just beginning to develop. If you cut them off at that point, you limit the learning that you can do in a situation. So her insight, her ability to feel and understand the inherent emptiness of those feelings, her point of view is what transforms her suffering into Dharma practice. When we take the precepts, when we take Jukai, as several people will be doing in a couple of weeks here in this room, we vow to take refuge in Dharma. That's one of the vows that we make in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. That's three of the vows, of the 16 Bodhisattva vows that we take. And taking refuge in Dharma is just that, being able to see each situation as an opportunity for practice. So we're often afraid to jump from that flagpole of idealism. If I'm virtuous, then I'll be rewarded. We're often afraid to jump off that flagpole into our own foxiness, into our own ordinary, deluded human beingness. We'd rather think if we just try hard enough, if we just, oh, we're enlightened now, so things are okay, we're free. If we're afraid to jump out of that, and it looks like a long way down, but it's actually, anyone who has ever jumped off a flagpole, a practice flagpole, full of that kind of idealism, knows that the drop is only 2 feet, then you're settled. You're settled in your foxiness. To do otherwise would be to be a fox unconsciously, and resentfully, and unhappily. You'd be a fox anyway, but you'd be a fox unhappily and unconsciously. So burn up your fox lives with grace and humor. Thank you very much.